This is The Takeaway for Friday, July 21st, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. We begin today with some history and some light on one of the most notorious and violent gangs in America.
MS-13. You know about MS-13?
Three fugitives are on the run after 40-plus raids targeting high-ranking MS-13 gang members today across Los Angeles.
It's not pleasant for them anymore, folks. It's not pleasant for them anymore. That's a bad group.
Officials in L.A. say more than half of the 44 people arrested are undocumented immigrants.
Not pleasant for MS-13. Get them the hell out of here, right? Get them out.
MS-13 is Mara Salvatrucha. It's a gang whose origins date back to the 1980s in the Pico Union neighborhood of central Los Angeles. Today, the gang is spread across the United States and into Canada, Mexico, El Salvador, and other parts of Central America, too. And under the Trump administration, it's become a major target of law enforcement. In April, Attorney General Jeff Sessions went to an MS-13 hotbed, Suffolk County, Long Island, in New York, and signaled a zero-tolerance policy on the gang.
This office here, a number of years ago, made substantial progress against MS-13. We've seen that in other United States attorneys that I've talked to. Felt like they hammered these organizations, but they've come back. So we know we can hammer them again, and we will do so.
But is the hammer the right approach to dealing with MS-13? Jose Miguel Cruz is director of research at the Latin American and Caribbean Center at Florida International University, and he joins me now. Miguel, welcome.
Thank you, Todd.
What are the origins of MS-13?
Well, MS-13 started in L.A., Southern California, in the early 1980s, and was formed basically by a group of Salvadoran migrants, young Salvadoran migrants, who started hanging out together in the streets. And actually, they at the beginning were a group of stoners, right? They attended concerts of rock. They hang out together. They basically just wanted to be together. And they take their name from their origin. They were all, most of them were Salvadoran migrants. So that's why they're called Mara Salvatrucha.
How did they go from being a bunch of kids hanging out in L.A., smoking pot and going to shows, to being a criminal enterprise?
Well, there were several factors, right? First, the overall culture, the gang culture in L.A. basically influenced them. But also, law enforcement had a lot to do in the sense that some of these kids, actually, they broke the law. They went sent into prison. But in prison, they got together and they started to form this sort of identity of a gang, of a youth group, and started to get involved in criminal activities increasingly.
So is this a gang with a strong national leadership? Are we talking a hierarchical vertical structure or more of a franchise model?
It's more like a franchise model, but in the case of El Salvador and in the case of Central America, they have a strong leadership. It is not one single person the leader, but a sort of board, a sort of group of leaders that manage all the things gang-related with MS-13. So it's very different to talk about MS-13 in Central America and MS-13 in the United States. In the United States, they are basically a group of small cliques, small cells in some communities that usually don't have any important connection between them, and they just use the name MS-13. In Central America, and specifically in El Salvador, they are more like a vertical organization with a strong leadership. But that leadership really doesn't have much influence on what is happening in the U.S.
Jose Miguel, there's been some very high-profile violence, of course, at the hands of MS-13, definitely in Washington, D.C. Is this common for the gang? Is it for sort of typical drug turf reasons that we often see gang violence?
Well, this gang is notoriously violent. This comes from the nature of Hispanic gangs in general in the United States. Hispanic gangs in the United States tend to be more violent, more aggressive. They use violence as an expression. And MS-13 is an example of that. But we have to remember also, these are, in essence, these are kids. These are people from 12 to 17, 18 years old who have been raised in violence. Some of them are coming from very violent families. They have been victims of abuse, and they basically are using that culture, nonviolence, in the streets. So certainly they are violent, but they use this as an expression of their way of being gangs.
So how does MS-13 make its money? Are they out there competing with drug cartels, trafficking drugs over international borders?
No, these are essentially youth gangs. They are not that much into the transnational drug trafficking phenomenon. They rather get their money by extorting the population at the local level. And this is the source of the revenue, essentially, in Central America. They extort, you know, large amounts of people in territories. They control communities, and they get money from poor people, actually. That's why they are also called the mafia of the poor. They really don't control drug trafficking other than what happens at the very local level. So they are not like, you know, like a Mexican cartel or a Colombian cartel. They are a youth gang who happen to have grown that much that you can find them in almost every city in northern Central America and some cities of Mexico. But the way they operate is very different in Central America from the way they operate in the United States.
So why this moment now when the Justice Department is going after MS-13? Is there any particular spike in violence that makes this the moment for law enforcement?
There have been some waves of violence in some communities in the United States, in New York, in Long Island, as you mentioned, or in Virginia. But these are very localized sort of waves of violence and only affect some communities. I don't think, and I wouldn't say, that MS-13 is a national threat for the security of Americans. They are indeed a threat for Central American governments and for the Central American societies as a whole, but not in the United States. And they are, you know, the threat is very localized and very much has been under control by the authorities here in the United States. I think the reason why the president is talking about MS-13 is because I think they are the perfect scapegoats in the sense that, yeah, certainly they are violent. They are formed by communities of migrants, Central American migrants, and that basically helps the administration to make the point of the threat represented by migration.
So using MS-13 more of an example, then, is what you're saying. This is a localized problem, then, with a nationalized Justice Department. The Attorney General says on Long Island, we're targeting you. Do you see an approach that national law enforcement can take that would be effective against local MS-13 gangs?
I think what has been done so far at the national level, what the FBI has been doing for the last 15 years, has been successful. And for instance, you haven't heard of MS-13 for a long time. You don't hear of MS-13 in LA, for instance, in Southern California, in the way that you're hearing in New York. Why? Because the LAPD changed their approach to gangs some time ago, and they have been somehow successful in dealing with MS-13. So the way that this administration is in bringing back this problem and putting into the national arena, I don't think is helpful, because the way of addressing the problem of gangs in the United States is by strengthening communities and communities working with local enforcement. We don't see that sort of approach and what Attorney Sessions or the president have said so far.
So you're not suggesting then that MS-13 isn't worthwhile in going after. You're simply suggesting that the Department of Justice approach, a national approach, isn't going to work.
I don't think it's going to work, basically, because this is a local level program, a community level program in which the local enforcement working with federal forces have a major role to play, not the national authorities. To the extent that we focus at the national level and we miss all the things that are happening at the community level, we are not taking the right approach.
Jose Miguel Cruz, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
Jose Miguel Cruz is Director of Research at the Latin American and Caribbean Center at Florida International University. President Trump's latest comments in a New York Times interview have raised questions once again about whether he's contemplating trying to fire Robert Mueller the special counsel tasked with investigating possible criminal activity related to Russia's interference in the 2016 campaign. Now, the Washington Post reports the president is already inquiring about his power to pardon his family members, even himself. For now, though, the investigation into Russian interference in 2016 goes on, and part of it has cast new scrutiny on the integrity of the American electoral system. This spring, the South Carolina State Election Commission released a report describing nearly 150,000 attempts to penetrate that state's voter registration system on Election Day. State officials say those numbers are overinflated. They say the system firewall was doing its job when it blocked internet traffic. None of those attempts to break in were successful, but the report sounds an alarm on the vulnerability of all state voting systems nationwide, even in places like South Carolina, which wasn't particularly hotly contested in the presidential race. Duncan Buell is professor in the Department of Computer Science and Engineering at the University of South Carolina.
Software is very hard, and verifying that computer security is done right, it's not something you can just set up passively and assume that, things are working. Our system in South Carolina is more than 500,000 lines of code. That's a lot of code to try to make sure that you got absolutely right every time.
What's the greatest risk here, Professor, or maybe the two or three greatest risks? People get focused on the idea of changing vote tallies. You know, the real result was Johnson won, but hackers changed it to say, no, Smith won. That's an obvious risk. What are some others?
One of the major things that has not, I think, received enough press, although people are talking about it more, is the problem of corrupting the voter registration database, which then disrupts the election. If you go in and target a few specific locations and change 25 or 30,000 addresses at exactly the right time so that that gets propagated to the precinct level poll books, then you have a lot of people showing up to vote at their precinct and being told they're not registered or not registered there. And that kind of disruption could cause very long lines. It could discourage people from voting, and it could suppress the vote if you chose to do it in some targeted areas where you knew that the vote was likely to swing one way or the other strongly.
Is that very obvious risk, changing vote tallies, changing outcomes? Is that something that people in your position consider a likely type of attack, or are you worried about the more insidious type that you mentioned with voter registration rolls?
I think that the two biggest issues are the voter registration rolls, which would cause a disruption, and the tallying software, which would cause a corruption of the election results. It is always said by the election officials that the vote tallying stuff is not connected to the internet, but there are a lot of us who wonder whether there might not be indirect paths from the internet by way of flash memory cards or other kinds of things that are used to program the machines. So when those of us in the integrity community talk about not being connected to the internet, we mean really not connected, not plugged in with flash drives, not plugged into a wire, not plugged into Wi-Fi, literally disconnected.
So Duncan Buell, this attack of 150,000 bots, was it probing? Was it looking for vulnerabilities? How do you interpret what was going on there?
I don't think we really know at all what those things were. The thing that's curious is that suddenly it drops off in April to a third of that. So presumably, if we're down to a third of what it was on Election Day, a lot of those on Election Day were actually looking for some malicious activity to happen.
Professor Buell, there was some testimony in front of the Senate several weeks ago where a computer scientist was hired to assess the safety of the voting system in the District of Columbia. And he and his team were able to penetrate that system, change vote tallies, and he said nobody knew about it for days later.
We've studied touchscreen and optical scan systems, and in every single case, we've found ways for attackers to sabotage machines and to steal votes.
Does that surprise you?
Not at all. No, that was Alex Halderman, whom I know, and I think every system he's gone after, he has successfully attacked.
As you know, the former Secretary of Homeland Security, Jay Johnson, made a move at one point to declare state voting systems critical national infrastructure. Now, that comes along with lots of implications about having to answer to the federal government. But do you think that such a designation would be a good idea and would help states get on the same page about security?
Viewing the election systems as critical infrastructure, or as, you know, a critical infrastructure in a layman's term without all the legal baggage, that to me is a no-brainer. Yes, it's critical, and it's critical for people in South Carolina to know what's going on in Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin, because that has an impact on us as well. So there needs to be some sort of organized, updated information sharing about what people are doing, why they're doing it, why systems are breaking, why systems are working. And I think a lot of that is not necessarily going on right now.
But you watched the 2016 election, Duncan Buell. You've seen the reports on attempted attacks in your state. You've heard the reports from your colleagues about what they've been able to accomplish with simulated attacks on other systems. What's your nightmare scenario when it comes to hacking in a U.S. election?
If I were to think of the nightmare scenario that is most likely to be possible, would be to have an election like a quadrennial election in 2020 where we could not actually determine what the outcome should have been. If there were a sufficient number of states where a sufficient number of votes were in question, then you really wouldn't know who won. And one of the characteristics of elections is that it's really hard to do a do-over, because disrupting is easier than corrupting. What worries me is the idea that you could cause enough of a fuss, like 2000 in Florida, where you really actually had no way of knowing what the proper outcome was. And I think that's a real possibility.
Duncan Buell, professor in the Department of Computer Science and Engineering at the University of South Carolina. Professor, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
It's been nearly 4 months since the repeal of North Carolina's so-called bathroom bill, which restricted access to public restrooms for transgender people. That bill sparked protests and also economic consequences as sports organizations and businesses withdrew from North Carolina. Now, Texas may be treading into similar waters. Proposed legislation similar to the North Carolina bill is being debated by Texas senators today in a special session, and members of the public are getting a chance to testify. Mark P. Jones is a fellow in political science at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy, and he joins me now. Professor Jones, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
This proposed legislation in Texas, this bathroom bill, do we know if it's similar to North Carolina and what it would do?
Well, it's relatively similar to North Carolina in that it does two things. First, it restricts in public buildings people's use of bathrooms and locker rooms to what's on their birth certificate, that is their biological sex. It also would gut non-discrimination ordinances throughout Texas in cities and counties that require accommodation for transgender people in the use of restrooms in restaurants, hotels, and other places that are of public access.
So that means if a city or a locality in Texas wants to have a non-discrimination ordinance, this would negate it.
Yeah, it would negate any future ones, and it would also gut the more than two dozen existing ones throughout the state in cities like Dallas and San Antonio and Bexar County, and particularly with Bexar County and San Antonio being important because that's where the NCAA Final Four is going to be held in March of 2018.
And with the NCAA Final Four coming to Texas, I mean, this is exactly what was going on in North Carolina, Mark P. Jones. Do lawmakers in Texas see the North Carolina example, and are there any fears that they're walking into a form of public and corporate protest that could make a lot of money go away from their state? It did in North Carolina.
Right. There are tremendous fears, especially in the Texas business community, that if this bill passes, that it would result in the loss of convention business. It would result in the cancellation of sporting events like the Final Four, and it would result in reduced corporate relocations and investment in the state, especially in the growing tech sector. But this is really part of a broader split within the Republican Party, where the moderate wing sees that completely and is up trying to oppose this, but the movement conservative or Tea Party wing doesn't really care.
It sounds almost as simple, Mark P. Jones, as the movement conservative wing picking a fight.
Very much so. This bill is really a manufactured issue. It was manufactured by Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick as a way to bolster his conservative or social conservative bona fides among Republican primary voters.
Sure, but I'm also sure that a lot of conservatives in North Carolina had a very similar idea when they passed a very similar law. They wound up backing down when some very, very big money and some very bad PR hit their state. I mean, that kind of politics is just as real.
Right. And I think part of it, if you look at it from a cynical perspective, the lieutenant governor, as well as his supporters, can have their cake and eat it too. That is, he's going to gain a lot of support among social conservatives for fighting what they consider to be the good fight on this values issue. On the other hand, since the Speaker of the Texas House, Joe Strauss, is a centrist conservative moderate, he's going to use his control of the House to block this legislation. You know, in some ways, we're dealing with political theater where social conservatives are pushing this legislation, and it's going to fly out of the Senate with full passage. Regardless of the testimony of people today, that's falling on deaf ears. The conservative majority on that committee is going to pass this legislation. It's going to go to the Senate floor. It's going to get kicked out of the Senate and sent over to the House next week. But in the House, it's likely to die.
So what you're saying, Mark Jones, is that the key to picking a political fight is making sure you never have to take a punch.
Exactly. So Lieutenant Governor Patrick will be able to claim to social conservatives that he did everything possible to try to get this legislation that they like passed, but he's not going to have to pay the bill among business leaders or convention groups in Houston and Dallas and San Antonio and Austin who come to him next year when saying our business is down 20% because you passed this legislation. So it's a tightrope act. That is, if the speaker said, I've had it with y'all, I'm going to let it go through, I think that the lieutenant governor would be like the dog that catches the car and not really know what to do with it.
Mark P. Jones is a fellow in political science at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy. Mark P. Jones, thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure.
One of these days, you're going to die there.
Oh, they sound depressed in the control room today for movie day. Fridays are movies here on The Takeaway. That means Rafer Guzman with Newsday and The Takeaway, the film critic, is here with me. Hi, Rafer.
Hey, Todd.
We've got three selections for the movies, and we're going to get to it. We've got Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets, which is a green screen technological spectacular. Girls Trip is out, and also Dunkirk, the war period piece, which looks amazing. You want to do some trivia?
First. All right.
I mentioned Dunkirk, Christopher Nolan directing. It's got Kenneth Branagh in it. It's got Finn Whitehead. Here's your trivia coming. Don't answer now. We're going to save this for the end. And by the way, if you know this, hit me up on Twitter. Try to get in on this. If you're first in, we'll try to see if Rafer knows the answer too. All right, Dunkirk. In addition to the other stars that I mentioned, Rafer, Cillian Murphy and Tom Hardy are starring in Dunkirk. Here's your trivia now. Here's Cillian Murphy and Tom Hardy chatting together in another production.
Good morning, Mr. Solomons.
Yeah, it is. Nice little place you got here, Thomas. Or is it? A foreclosure of a gambling debt from some poor young lord who you pumped full of opium in one of your casinos. Was that just tittle-tattle?
Well, Tom Hardy with some tittle-tattle there. Mm-hmm. Name that show, Rafer. If you know it, hit me on Twitter. Rafer is looking at me with a bit of a quizzical look on his face, but he knows a lot about Dunkirk, directed by Christopher Nolan. Let's listen.
The call went out. We have to go to Dunkirk. Ready on the stern line.
What are you doing? You know where we're going.
Into war, George.
I'll be useful, sir.
One of ours.
He's on me.
I'm on him.
Allied soldiers pouring into Belgium, and an epic trailer that made me think of Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah, that was Mark Rylance that we heard right there as the captain of a little boat called Moonstone, who is one of the many civilian sailors who sailed across the channel toward the French beach of Dunkirk to evacuate the troops. What's kind of interesting about this movie is that it's not a battle film. It's an evacuation film. Mm. Dunkirk was a retreat that somehow the British turned into a symbolic victory, and that's what's kind of interesting about this. You know, you're were talking about Tom Hardy, Kenneth Branagh, Mark Rylance. No major stars in this film. The real star here, of course, is Christopher Nolan. This is him doing this amazing World War II film. It is so visually intense. You are in the cockpit with Tom Hardy. You are on that boat. You are on the ground, on the beach, in these boats that are being sunk by the Germans. It's really an incredible visual experience. The one thing I would say is, there aren't real characters in this film. We don't really know people's backstories, their personal motivations, except for just the sheer will to survive, which makes the film very real. I'm sure that's how it was if you were a soldier there on the beach. It kept me a little bit at arm's length emotionally from the characters. But I will say that if you're going in to see a spectacle, and if you can see this in IMAX, it is worth it. It is an incredible cinematic experience.
The opening scene, the famous opening sequence of Saving Private Ryan, was about the battle, not about a character. And then the characters came in afterward, and this film seems to be more about that. That battle is the star.
This is really essentially 120 minutes of action, of just pure visceral physical action. And again, you know, does it rival Saving Private Ryan's battle scene, one of the most famous battle scenes on film? I would have to say yes.
Oh, great. Well, it sounds like it's not to be missed. Oh, we got to shift gears a little bit now for Girls Trip.
Okay.
A very different film. This is starring Regina Hall, Queen Latifah, Jada Pinkett Smith. I saw this trailer. It looks hilarious.
Look like a bedazzler threw up on that thing.
What? This is very fashionable. It's up today and yesterday. It's very retro.
How about we save it for the last night
of our lives?
So The Hangover was a huge hit, and then there were a couple of follow-on sort of style movies of, in the style of The Hangover, with different types of cast, and this seems to be of a piece.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is an attempt to do an all-female, African-American, R-rated, raunchy version of The Hangover, and why not? And when you've got a cast like this, I mean, you really can't lose. Queen Latifah is great, Regina Hall is great, Jada Pinkett Smith, who we don't see that much of anymore, she's really good, but the breakout star here is a woman named Tiffany Haddish, who has been around for a while. I wasn't familiar with her, but Will Packer, who produced Think Like a Man and basically made a movie star out of Kevin Hart, I think has just done the same for Tiffany Haddish. She is so good, so funny, so charming, and I think this is going to be the movie that we remember as her breakout moment.
Lots of laughs. We got to go to the cosmos for a minute. I was almost hoping to avoid this, but we're not going to avoid it. Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. Let's do listen to this.
Welcome to Alpha, the City of a Thousand Planets.
Alex, can you update us?
I'd be delighted to. The Alpha station has grown 7% this year. And since it left the terrestrial orbit, it has traveled almost 700 million miles.
Population?
Almost 30 million. 3,236 species from the four corners of the universe live on board.
She sounds exactly like the woman who tells me to silence my cell phone before the movie.
That's right. She's about as exciting as it gets in this film. I'm going to have to say it's Dane DeHaan, Cara Delevingne playing 28th century operatives who are trying to save this city of a thousand planets. Luc Besson, who I love, you know, yeah. Fifth Element, Lucy.
Yeah.
Such a disaster, this film. I'm sorry to say, so creaky, old-fashioned, and sort of not aware that it's kind of seems like a latecomer to the whole science fiction genre. It's based on French comic books. People say that Star Wars ripped off Valerian, stole a lot of the best ideas, like the trash compactor scene and things like that. Maybe so, but this just feels so out of date and not fresh.
I saw this trailer and I thought, how many square meters of green screen had to die?
Boy, a lot.
To make this thing.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you and I might have been on the same page. All right, let's do go back to Dunkirk, however, because I gave you a little bit of trivia. I played you Killian
Murphy.
Killian Murphy, yes, and Tom Hardy having this conversation.
Oh, foreclosure of a gambling debt from some poor young lord who you pumped full of opium in one of your casinos. Was that just tittle tattle?
Killian Murphy and Tom Hardy. Rafer, what show are they on there?
I'm drawing a blank, as usual. I'm falling down on the job, Todd.
J.P. Dempsey knows it. He just tweeted me. He says that's Peaky Blinders on Netflix, which is a fantastic period piece, 1920s Birmingham in England, organized crime story. It's absolutely fantastic. Do check that out, by the way, if you haven't seen it. Rafer Guzman, I'm sorry you didn't get it.
Do I get a consolation prize?
You have to see Valerian. That's your prize for that one.
Seen
Rafer
it.
Guzman with Newsday. Mm-hmm. 1967, for some, it was the summer of love. For countless others in urban centers across the United States, it was dubbed the long, hot summer of 1967. Across America, Atlanta, Boston, Chicago, Tampa, in Detroit, it earned a name, the 12th Street Riot, it was called. The uprising lasted nearly a week, and by the end, 43 people were dead, over 1,000 others injured, and more than 2,000 buildings had been destroyed. It all began in the early morning on July 23rd, a Sunday, 50 years ago, when police raided an illegal after-hours bar on the corner of 12th Street and Claremont Avenue.
My name is Daryl Buchanan. I grew up on the west side of Detroit on Virginia Park between 12th and 14th Street. I turned 12 the week of the rebellion of 1967.
The Virginia Park neighborhood is located in northwest Detroit. For Daryl, in the mid-1960s, it was home, and he loved it.
On a Sunday afternoon.
My neighborhood was a very vibrant neighborhood. It's interesting to me that I hear a lot of times it described as a ghetto or something of that nature, but to me, it couldn't have been a more enriching environment for a young person to grow up in. Just on my block, there was a market, there was a dairy, there was a meat market, there was a hardware store, there was a barber shop, and on the corner was a pharmacy. Dr. Mabin had his pharmacy right there on the corner. On a day-to-day basis, there was really nothing that we had to venture too far out of the neighborhood to get or any services that we needed. They were pretty much all right there.
At the request of Mayor Kavanaugh, we've made state police and National Guardsmen available to assist in dealing with what is a case of lawlessness and hoodlumism, and to protect the persons and property of people in the areas involved.
One of the things that I recognized real early, you know, coming from a neighborhood, Highland Park, where it was a very mixed environment, and moving to Virginia Park, where it was just black folk living over there, the difference was how, you know, we looked at the police department. When I was a little boy, I used to see police in Highland Park, and, you know, you could wave at them, you could talk to them. I moved on to Virginia Park, and I just noticed how whenever police would come around, a lot of my friends would just disperse.
Now, we've put in about 300 state police and about 600 National Guardsmen in the area to protect the people and the property from the acts of lawless elements.
That was a Sunday morning. I was an altar boy at St. Agnes. And so I was now doing 8 o'clock mass. I had to get up and, you know, iron my vestments and get ready to go to church. And nobody else in the house was up right then. My grandparents were asleep. My mother, she was an emergency room tech in Henry Ford Hospital. She worked midnights. And so the phone rang. And I ran to grab the phone before it woke anybody up. And it was my mother, and she was saying, "You're not going to church this morning." "Whoa, I'm serving mass this morning." And she says, "You can't go to church. There's a riot, and it's taking place right on 12th Street near the church."
Riots, looting, and public disorder will just not be tolerated.
Then I started paying attention to the fact that I could hear people outside, but it didn't really, you know, alert me to anything because, you know, maybe somebody was up, and, you know, it's the summertime, so, you know, maybe people were up early getting ready for, you know, a barbecue or something, because I could smell some smoke, too, but it wasn't like, you know, it alarmed me at that point. And then I went outside on the front porch, and I could see all kinds of activity, people coming from 12th Street down Virginia Park, you know, and people had shopping carts, they were carrying all kind of items. And I'm just looking like, what is going on? It was like an explosion, all of the anger that was in the neighborhood at that time. I made my way down to 12th Street to start watching, seeing some of the things that were going on. It was really heartbreaking. Now we're starting to see not just the violence of the looting that was taking place, spillage of broken glass and some of the merchandise that was strewn up and down the street. Then is when they started setting fire to some of the buildings. Then we started to, you know, move away from 12th Street. The police were overwhelmed. You could tell that right away. For the most part, you know, you saw the police kind of pass through and maybe disperse a crowd, but as soon as they got past you, the crowd built up again right behind where they just came from. And it continued on and on and on.
I'm declaring a public state of emergency in these three cities. And I'm also indicating that I will promulgate such rules, orders, and regulations as I deem necessary to protect life and property and to bring the emergency situation within the affected areas under control.
By the time the National Guard got into the neighborhood, you saw a difference. You know, just the level of force that they came into the neighborhood with.
At 11:02 a.m. this morning, I instructed the Secretary of Defense, Mr. McNamara, to initiate the movement of the troops which the governor had requested.
You know, growing up as a little boy, you know, in that period, all little boys played Army. You know, we're just fascinated by that. There were all kind of TV shows about World War II and all of that. But when we actually saw armed soldiers in our neighborhood, it had a very serious impact on all of us because it was nothing like the game that we had been playing before. When you see a tank roll down your street, the noise that it makes, and then you see how it leaves an imprint in the street when it goes by, that really has an impact on you. At night, we could hear the gunfire and we could hear the power and the force of, you know, what the weaponry that they brought to the mix. There was a house that for years had the scars on it. It, you know, they said that there were some snipers in this house and, you know, they pulled up on it in one of those tanks. And when they started firing, you know, those bullets at that house, you could hear that throughout the entire neighborhood. And I remember I went by and actually saw through the iron fence, you could see the bullet, you know, marks, the trail when the bullets were going through and hit that iron fence. And you could see how the bricks, you know, and the masonry on this building was just torn up by these bullets. It was like seeing war up close. I don't think we ever played Army after that. In a lot of ways, I saw what I knew to be a very vibrant neighborhood being destroyed. And I knew then that it was never going to be the same.
Detroit resident Daryl Buchanan remembering the summer of 1967, 50 years ago. Daryl is now director of My Brother's Keeper in the state of Michigan. And special thanks to the Detroit Historical Society. You can check out their Detroit 67 project at Detroit1967.org. That's all for us this hour. Have a great weekend and thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.